This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Hello and welcome to Uprise Radio with your host Koshin and no Zan this week. Zan is on a very special top secret mission that cannot be disclosed. They will be back hopefully in a couple of weeks. So it's just me. There is no Zan to save you this week or save me. Most importantly, no co-host. So it will just be a bit of a yap for 30 minutes. And that song that you just heard is Learn from Lei Feng's Good Example. It is a song that comes out of China. It's a nice little song produced during an era of propaganda. And it is the reason I thought it would be good to play that is because we are going to be talking today about the recent summit between the US and China that happened last week. Many of you may have seen that Trump made a large state visit along with an entourage of CEOs and top US officials to Beijing, where he met with China's President Xi Jinping, and they discussed supposedly all manner of things. And we will be unpacking that, taking a look at how it went, what the outcome of that was, and where we go from here. So I thought I would begin with a quick look at what the lead up to this meeting was like. It's actually been in the works for quite some time. Trump, when he took office last year, there was a lot of discussion around this meeting already. I think maybe even it started before he took office, actually. There was discussion around who was going to go to who, basically. The US and the Trump team were very firm on the idea that President Xi had to come over to the US and meet with them on US soil. And the Chinese team basically thought the same thing in reverse, that the U.S. should make the visit to China. And it was seen as a bit of a push and pull over who was in a top position, who wanted it more, basically. They were both playing hard to get. And it is interesting that that narrative really faded away. And then quietly, the U.S. announced that they were going to go to China, but it was definitely not framed in the same context. It was not seen as any kind of, I don't know, that they were losing anything, any position. It was just that they were going to go over there to have a meeting, and that was that. So it's been in the works for a while, but it finally happened. And the big things that were being discussed, especially the media talked about the three T's a lot. The three T's of the meeting, which were Taiwan, Tehran, and then I actually saw multiple versions of what the third T was. It was either trade or technology, depending on which outlet you looked at. But certainly a lot of discussion around Tehran and Taiwan were expected. And the U.S. position on Tehran and Taiwan should be pretty fixed in place. They have been for a while. On Tehran, the U.S. position is sort of now that China should be helping the U.S. in some way to pressure Iran to reopen the Strait of Hormuz to get the oil flowing. China gets a lot of their oil from the region. They get a lot of oil from Iran. But they're so far not very affected. They've been able to get their oil out. But the US has went in with a position that they were hoping that they could negotiate China into not buying Iranian oil anymore. And on that one, on the first tee, I would say they walked away not winning. They did not win that one. China has not said that they're going to stop buying oil from Iran. So score one on the three tees, I would say, probably goes to China on that. And then on technology or trade, it's a bit of a mixed bag. This seems to be the big win for the US side. China has agreed to buy somewhere in the range of over 50 planes from Boeing for, seems like, domestic air travel. If that doesn't seem like the biggest deal in the world to you, then I would agree, but I would also think that we're missing something because it's really getting spruiked by the US. I went onto the official White House website where they had a press release, and I also want to say that when you go on the White House website, a pop-up comes up with Trump, a little figurine of Trump looking at you, and it says, "Welcome to the Golden Age," and it has some information about all the deals that were made during this visit. And yeah, they say 100 planes, China's going to buy 100 planes from Boeing, and good for them. That sounds great. That's a huge win if you own Boeing. That's pretty good. If you are anyone else, it doesn't seem like this was a big major shift, in any way. The US is still not following through completely on their threats of tariffs to China. China supposedly has agreed not to restrict the flow of rare earth minerals, which we've discussed on the show previously, but to give a quick summary, China has a huge amount of the world's rare earth refining happens in China. And that gives China a lot of control over the flow of rare earths that are then used in advanced computer parts, silicon chips especially, but also the US military is heavily reliant on the flow of these rare earths. And during the trade war last year, China hit the button on restricting the flow of rare earths, and was a pretty quick win for them. America very quickly started walking backwards a lot of their tariff threats. So they'll be happy that China is saying that they're not going to restrict the flow of rare earths, but that was also the case before they had their meeting last week. So they're kind of claiming a win that isn't much of a win. Overall, I think it was not a very dramatic meeting. The symbolism seems to be the biggest takeaway. Just that there was the contrast between this and previous meetings between U.S. and Chinese presidents is pretty big. It really was more of a meeting of equals than the usual story of U.S. dominance, the U.S. being global number one hegemon, and anyone they meet is sort of a subservient country. This was very much China sort of positioning itself as an equal global superpower, and a lot of talk around strategic cooperation and friendship and these sorts of things. On a side note, I do have to say that Trump looked like he was having a phenomenal time. He seemed very impressed. The ballroom, which we've discussed previously, was definitely on his mind when he was looking at the scale of the Chinese infrastructure. The Chinese government buildings are massive. They're very impressive. And there was some jealousy for sure, I would say. But that's a little, I don't want to psychoanalyze too much I don't want to delve into the mind of Donald Trump, but that was my takeaway from watching, that he seemed very happy, seemed very impressed. The entourage that he went with was interesting because it was sort of like Trump going with the real leaders of the US, being the corporate interests, the CEOs of many of the major corporations and especially tech companies all accompanied him. And I guess, you know, who knows what deals were made on the side that weren't official kind of government-to-government deals. I'm sure a lot of side deals were made on this trip with those people that we won't be able to find out about in the same sort of press releases. They'll be a little bit more hushed up, but down the line, I'm sure we'll see the results of that. I don't know where I'm going with that. Yeah, it's the entourage was very interesting. Elon Musk filming everything, looking very annoying, probably the most annoying guy you could have on the team. I saw Trump officials getting stopped for not having their credentials, which is very funny because they are, you know, very high ranking. I read about in 2018, in the last state visit that Trump went on to China, an incident that wasn't reported at the time that was kept quiet was that the military official who follows Trump around with what's called the nuclear football, it's a briefcase full of the codes that the president has to read out if he wants to launch a nuclear missile. This guy follows the president everywhere he goes. I guess he got separated from Trump and he tried to get past a line of sort of just security guards to try to get into the room with Trump, and they wouldn't allow him. And there was a physical altercation between American Secret Service and Chinese security. And I mean, that would have been very embarrassing. But the fact that the nuclear football was in the middle of that is, it's something. It's definitely something. I don't think too much could have gone wrong, but it definitely could have been a bigger incident. And we'll take a quick break and then hopefully go over some of the history of the US and China and some bigger diplomatic incidents that have occurred between the two countries. So we'll be right back.
3CR's annual Radiothon fundraiser is almost here.
This June we'll be asking for your donations to support 3CR.
Your donation during Radiothon keeps the station radical and enables us to give voice to our community for another year.
All donations over $2 are tax deductible.
3CR Radiothon is coming. Show your support by donating this June.
3CR, celebrating 50 years.
Welcome back to Uprise Radio. If you're just tuning in, you're here with Koshin this week with no Zan. Zan is away on a what can only be described as a top secret mission that will not be disclosed on public airways. I'm talking about the recent trip between the summit between the US and China. And we've been talking about the three T's, the trade or technology, Tehran and Taiwan. And I want to talk about Taiwan because I think that is the most consequential component out of the three T's, which I should say the three T's, I think that was a very convenient phrase to latch onto. But I think a lot more was discussed than falls into the category of these three T's. But Taiwan is... It was described by President Xi as the most important aspect of the China-US relationship. It is the biggest flashpoint and potential for any future conflict between the two countries. It is the biggest and most fundamental disagreement that the two countries have is over the status of Taiwan. And it does seem as though there was some movement on the official US position on Taiwan after the trip. There might be a softening of their position, but I just wanted to quickly sort of go over the history of China, Taiwan, and the US and give a bit of background on what this disagreement is all about. So Taiwan, if you have your maps out, is an island off the coast of mainland China, just out to the east, below south of Japan. And following the Chinese Civil War, where, well, okay, let's go back a little bit further. Start of the 20th century, you have China's an agrarian imperial country. It's under the Qing Dynasty. And then it becomes a republic following a revolution. The republic is led by Sun Yat-sen, a very interesting figure in Chinese history because he is liked across the board. There's really no disagreement across the political spectrum. Everyone loves Sun Yat-sen in China. But following the declaration of this republic, China falls into a civil war between the KMT, that's the Kuomintang, that's the nationalist party, who were running the Republic of China, and the upstart Communist Party of China, which, you know, long story short, there's a lot of fighting, the Japan's involved, World War II is happening, but eventually the communists led by Mao Zedong ascend to victory across mainland China, but the nationalists, the Kuomintang, 2 million of 2 million Chinese in the party and associated with the party flee mainland China to Taiwan, which is at this point politically is a part of this political jurisdiction. This is not the sort of formal ending of the civil war. This is sort of seen as one move. The KMT set up shop in Taiwan with the assumption that they will move back to the mainland at some point and retake it. Mao Zedong on the mainland assumes that he will move in at some point and invade Taiwan and take it from the KMT. But a series of sort of, I don't know, political machinations, especially involving the U.S., they sort of change. They support Taiwan because they support the KMT. Then they change their minds, and then they go back to supporting Taiwan. So they kind of move around a few times, but the end result is that there's sort of this frozen conflict between different parties within within the Chinese Civil War. You have the Republic of China government in control of Taiwan, and you have the People's Republic of China government in control of the mainland. And then you can basically just fast forward to today. Not much has changed. It's really been frozen in that situation since then. And the official position of the United States is this position of what's called strategic ambiguity. It is this strategy of never really revealing whether or not they do support Taiwanese independence or whether they think that they should reunify. They never say, because the idea is that if they ever threw their support behind one side, that side would then be emboldened to make a move. So Taiwan is never formally declared independent, even though it operates autonomously. It is effectively an independent state, but it also, you know, is recognized within China as a breakaway province. I mean, it's the same as if any state in Australia had become independent. I mean, it would still be viewed internally as a part of Australian territory, and it's the same thing. There's this sort of mindset, but the only complicated thing really is that within Taiwan, the KMT, who are still a political force in Taiwan, but they're not in government right now, the Republic of China in Taiwan, their official position is also one of unification. They believe that they are still the legitimate authority within mainland China. So it's a lot more nuanced than just that there is a country off the coast of China that China wants to invade, which is sort of how it's portrayed. The history is a lot more intermingled and complicated and not helped by the U.S. Involving themselves in what is sort of, you can look at it as one of many, many failed two-state solutions that have been tried, especially in that region. I mean, you can look at South and North Vietnam. They were trying the same thing. South and North Korea, where they did do the same thing, but both South and North Korea both have departments in their government of departments of reunification. They both assume that at one point in the future they will eventually reunify the Korean Peninsula. It's a similar sort of thing in China and Taiwan, where there's this lingering unresolved tension, and what the U.S. does is very important, because if they do substantially change their position, it could have massive consequences. It could lead to a massive conflict between China and the U.S., which is the conflict to avoid, which I also have a short thing to read very soon. If we have a little bit of time at the end of the show, I would love to read maybe the worst article I've ever read in my life. And that is saying a lot. I also want to quickly say, I think there's a, I didn't write it down. I try to remember off the top of my head. There's a really good quote about Taiwan and Palestine. It's something along the lines of they're both imperialist creations, and the imperialist created Palestine. The imperialist created Israel in the Middle East to thwart the Arabs, and they created Taiwan in Asia to thwart the Chinese Communist Party. And I've probably butchered the quote massively, but you can see the intention there. And I think it's interesting. I mean, it's, yeah, there's definitely something to be said about, I think it definitely falls into the category of, yeah, the mythical two-state solution that is always tried and very rarely works. The idea to just go around redrawing the map to undermine your political adversaries is very rarely good for the people living in either of the places that are getting carved up. What else did I have to say? This would be a great place for Zan to come in and save me, because I've talked in a circle, but it's just me on the air. Let's have a little read of a great article that was written in the Wall Street Journal that I think really summarizes the American psyche, the mind of the intelligentsia living within the United States. It is titled, "The Future is Not Chinese. We have Apple, the NBA, and Sydney Sweeney. What do they have?" And I mean, the title really sums up the whole article. It is really genuinely someone who is paid to write professionally, making the argument that the U.S. has, not only do they have a bunch of tech companies and sports that they love to watch, but they also have Sydney Sweeney. And that is supposed to sort of, it's never a good sign when you are a global empire in decline and you're clinging to ways to stay relevant, and one of the things that you present is Sydney Sweeney as, I think it is genuinely, it's just what you think. It's just that, it's that basic, it's that transparent. But this line I really liked. Where is it? Talking about if there is a potential war between the U.S. and China, and he says, "No one should want war between the U.S. and China. But if it comes to that, I know which side I'd rather be on. The team that took Fallujah twice. The team that neutralized Fordo, Natanz, and Isfahan. The team that snatched Maduro." So, if this is where they're at, then I think the Chinese strategy of do nothing and win is, it's an unmitigated success. I think we should absolutely be switching where we hitch our wagon. I think we should do AUKUS, but with China. This is the future does not bode well for us if we stay tied to this declining empire in the United States. Don't have much else to say. I have a small ticket inspector update, and that is that they are still out there, even though public transport is free, but they are booking people for minor infractions, is what I've been told. I tried to do some investigative journalism. I tried to talk to them, but I think they saw through me and they didn't want to give up their information. But I've been told through sources that they are booking people for minor infractions like, I don't know, feet on seat, et cetera, so be careful out there. They are still watching you. They still want to fine you for anything. They're just trying to make life miserable. Well, that is the end of what I've got on that trip. Hopefully that was illuminating in some way or another. I really don't know if I hit any of the points that I was trying to make. Hopefully Zan's back next time and Zan can save all of us, myself and you, the audience. And I will go out on this song by Pete Seeger, Last Night I Had a Dream. And I will see you all, or you will all see me and Zan, hopefully, in a couple of weeks. Bye-bye.
Last night I had the strangest dream I never dreamed before. I dreamed the world had all agreed to put an end to war. I dreamed I saw a mighty room.